Chapter 87. First catch your boor, then kick him. Pudd'nhead Wilson's new calendar. Those latter days were days of bitter worry and trouble for the harassed reformers. From Mrs. Hammond we learned that on the 31st, the day after Johannesburg heard of the invasion, the Reform Committee repudiates Dr. Jamison's inroad. It also publishes its intention to adhere to the manifesto. It also earnestly desires that the inhabitants shall refrain from overt acts against the Boer government. It also distributes arms at the courthouse, and furnishes horses to the newly enrolled volunteers. It also brings a Transvaal flag into the committee room, and the entire body swear allegiance to it with uncovered heads and upraised arms. Also, 1,000 Lee Metford rifles have been given out to rebels. Also, in a speech, reformer Lionel Phillips informs the public that the Reform Committee delegation has been received with courtesy by the Government Commission, and been assured that their proposals shall be earnestly considered. That while the Reform Committee regretted Jamison's precipitate action, they would stand by him. Also, the populace are in a state of filled enthusiasm, and Sikhs can scarcely be restrained. They want to go out to meet Jamison, and bring him in with triumphal outcry. Also, the British High Commissioner has issued a damnifying proclamation against Jamison, and all British abettors of his game. It arrives January 1st. It is a difficult position for the reformers, and full of hindrances and perplexities. Their duty is hard, but plain. 1. They have to repudiate the inroad, and stand by the inroader. 2. They have to swear allegiance to the Boer government, and distribute cavalry horses to the rebels. 3. They have to forbid overt acts against the Boer government, and distribute arms to its enemies. 4. They have to avoid collision with the British government, but still stand by Jamison and their new oath of allegiance to the Boer government, taken, uncovered, in presence of its flag. They did such of these things as they could. They tried to do them all, in fact, did do them all, but only in turn, not simultaneously. In the nature of things they could not be made to simultan. In preparing for armed revolution and in talking revolution, were the reformers bluffing, or were they in earnest? If they were in earnest, they were taking great risks, as has been already pointed out. A gentleman of high position told me in Johannesburg that he had in his possession a printed document proclaiming a new government and naming its president one of the reform leaders. He said that this proclamation had been ready for issue, but was suppressed when the raid collapsed. Perhaps I misunderstood him. Indeed, I must have misunderstood him, for I have not seen mention of this large incident in print anywhere. Besides, I hope I am mistaken. For, if I am, then there is argument that the reformers were privately not serious, but were only trying to scare the Boer government into granting the desired reforms. The Boer government was scared, and it had a right to be. For if Mr. Rhodes' plan was to provoke a collision that would compel the interference of England, that was a serious matter. If it could be shown that that was also the reformers' plan and purpose, it would prove that they had marked out a feasible project, at any rate, although it was one which could hardly fail to cost them ruinously before England should arrive. But it seems clear that they had no such plan nor desire. If, when the worst should come to the worst, they meant to overthrow the government, they also meant to inherit the assets themselves, no doubt. This scheme could hardly have succeeded. With an army of Boers at their gates and 50,000 riotous blacks in their midst, the odds against success would have been too heavy even if the whole town had been armed. With only 2,500 rifles in the place, they stood really no chance. To me, the military problems of the situation are of more interest than the political ones, because by disposition I have always been especially fond of war. No, I mean fond of discussing war, and fond of giving military advice. If I had been with Jamison the morning after he started, I should have advised him to turn back. That was Monday. It was then that he received his first warning from a Boer source not to violate the friendly soil of the Transvaal. It showed that his invasion was known. If I had been with him on Tuesday morning and afternoon, when he received further warnings, I should have repeated my advice. If I had been with him the next morning, New Year's, when he received notice that a few hundred Boers were waiting for him a few miles ahead, I should not have advised, but commanded him to go back. And if I had been with him 2 or 3 hours later, a thing not conceivable to me, I should have retired him by force. For at that time he learned that the few hundred had now grown to 800, and that meant that the growing would go on growing. For, by authority of Mr. Garrett, one knows that Jamison's 600 were only 530 at most, when you count out his native drivers, etc., semicolon, and that the 530 consisted largely of green youths, raw young fellows, not trained and war-worn British soldiers. And I would have told Jamison that those lads would not be able to shoot effectively from horseback in the scamper and racket of battle, and that there would not be anything for them to shoot at, anyway, but rocks, for the Boers would be behind the rocks, not out in the open. I would have told him that 300 Boer sharpshooters behind rocks would be an overmatch for his 500 raw young fellows on horseback. If pluck were the only thing essential to battle winning, the English would lose no battles. But discretion, as well as pluck, is required when one fights Boers and Red Indians. In South Africa, the Briton has always insisted upon standing bravely up, unsheltered, before the hidden Boer, and taking the results. Jamison's men would follow the custom. Jamison would not have listened to me, he would have been intent upon repeating history according to precedent. Americans are not acquainted with the British Boer War of 1881, but its history is interesting, and could have been instructive to Jamison, if he had been receptive. I will cull some details of it from trustworthy sources, mainly from Russell's Natal. Mr. Russell is not a Boer, but a Briton. He is inspector of schools, and his history is a textbook whose purpose is the instruction of the natal English youth. After the seizure of the Transvaal, and the suppression of the Boer government by England in 1877, the Boers fretted for 3 years, and made several appeals to England for a restoration of their liberties, but without result. Then they gathered themselves together in a great mustache meeting at Krugersdorp, talked their troubles over, and resolved to fight for their deliverance from the British yoke. Krugersdorp, the place where the Boers interrupted the Jamison raid. The little handful of farmers rose against the strongest empire in the world. They proclaimed martial law and the re-establishment of their republic. They organized their forces, and sent them forward, to intercept the British battalions. This, although Sir Garnet Wolseley had but lately made proclamation that so long as the sun shone in the heavens, the Transvaal would be, and remain, English territory. And also in spite of the fact that the commander of the 94th Regiment, already on the march to suppress this rebellion, had been heard to say that the Boers would turn tail at the first beat of the big drum. South Africa as it is, by F. Reginald Statham. Page 82. London. T. Fisher and Wynne, 1897. 4 days after the flag raising, the Boer force which had been sent forward to forbid the invasion of the English troops met them at Bronkhorst's Pruett, 246 men of the 94th Regiment, in command of a colonel, the big drum beating, the band playing, and the first battle was fought. It lasted 10 minutes. Result. British loss, more than 150 officers and men, out of the 246. Surrender of the remnant. Boer loss, if any, not stated. They are fine marksmen, the Boers. From the cradle up, they live on horseback and hunt wild animals with the rifle. They have a passion for liberty and the Bible, and care for nothing else. General Sir George Coley, Lieutenant Governor and Commander-in-Chief in Natal, felt it his duty to proceed at once to the relief of the loyalists and soldiers beleaguered in the different towns of the Transvaal. He moved out with 1,000 men and some artillery. He found the Boers encamped in a strong and sheltered position on high ground at Lang's Neck, every Boer behind a rock. Early in the morning of the 28th January, 1881, he moved to the attack at the 58th Regiment, commanded by Colonel Dean, a mounted squadron of 70 men, the 60th Rifles, the Naval Brigade with 3 rocket tubes, and the artillery with 6 guns. He shelled the Boers for 20 minutes, then the assault was delivered, the 58th marching up the slope in solid column. The battle was soon finished, with this result, according to Russell, British loss in killed and wounded, 174. Boer loss, trifling. Colonel Dean was killed, and apparently every officer above the grade of lieutenant was killed or wounded, for the 58th retreated to its camp in command of a lieutenant. Fricka as it is. That ended the second battle. On the 7th of February, General Coley discovered that the Boers were flanking his position. The next morning he left his camp at Mount Pleasant and marched out and crossed the Ingogo River with 270 men, started up the Ingogo Heights, and there fought a battle which lasted from noon till nightfall. He then retreated, leaving his wounded with his military chaplain, and in recrossing the now swollen river lost some of his men by drowning. That was the third Boer victory. Result, according to Mr. Russell, British loss 150 out of 270 engaged. Boer loss, 8 killed, 9 wounded, 17. There was a season of quiet now, but at the end of about 3 weeks Sir George Coley conceived the idea of climbing, with an infantry and artillery force, the steep and rugged mountain of Amajuba in the night, a bitter hard task, but he accomplished it. On the way he left about 200 men, to guard a strategic point, and took about 400 up the mountain with him. When the sun rose in the morning, there was an unpleasant surprise for the Boers. Yonder were the English troops visible on top of the mountain 2 or 3 miles away, and now their own position was at the mercy of the English artillery. The Boer chief resolved to retreat up that mountain. He asked for volunteers, and got them. The storming party crossed the swale, and began to creep up the steeps, and from behind rocks and bushes they shot at the soldiers on the skyline, as if they were stalking deer, says Mr. Russell. There was continuous musketry fire, steady and fatal on the one side, wild and ineffectual on the other. The Boers reached the top, and began to put in their ruinous work. Presently the British broke and fled for their lives down the rugged steep. The Boers had won the battle. Result in killed and wounded, including among the killed the British general. British loss, 226, out of 400 engaged. Boer loss, 1 killed, 5 wounded. That ended the war. England listened to reason, and recognized the Boer Republic, a government which has never been in any really awful danger since, until Jameson started after it with his 500 young fellows. To recapitulate, the Boer farmers and British soldiers fought 4 battles, and the Boers won them all. Result of the 4, in killed and wounded. British loss, 700 men. Boer loss, so far as known, 23 men. It is interesting, now, to note how loyally Jameson and his several trained British military officers tried to make their battles conform to precedent. Mr. Garrett's account of the raid is much the best one I have met with, and my impressions of the raid are drawn from that. When Jameson learned that near Krugersdorp he would find 800 Boers waiting to dispute his passage, he was not in the least disturbed. He was feeling as he had felt 2 or 3 days before, when he had opened his campaign with a historic remark to the same purport as the one with which the commander of the 94th had opened the Boer-British War of 14 years before. That commander's remark was that the Boers would turn tail at the first beat of the big drum. Jameson's was that with his all young fellows he could kick the persons of the Boers all round the Transvaal. He was keeping close to historic precedent. Jamison arrived in the presence of the Boers. They, according to precedent, were not visible. It was a country of ridges, depressions, rocks, ditches, moraines of mining tailings, not even as favorable for cavalry work as Lane's Neck had been in the former disastrous days. Jamison shot at the ridges and rocks with his artillery, just as General Coley had done at the Neck, and did them no damage and persuaded no Boer to show himself. Then about 100 of his men formed up to charge the ridge according to the 58th's precedent at the Neck, but as they dashed forward they opened out in a long line, which was a considerable improvement on the 58th's tactics. When they had gotten to within 200 yards of the ridge the concealed Boers opened out on them, and emptied 20 saddles. The unwounded dismounted and fired at the rocks over the backs of their horses. But the return fire was too hot, and they mounted again, and galloped back or crawled away into a clump of reeds for cover, where they were shortly afterward taken prisoners as they lay among the reeds. Some 30 prisoners were so taken, and during the night which followed the Boers carried away another 30 killed, and wounded the wounded to Kruger's Derp Hospital. 60%. Of the assaulted force disposed of according to Mr. Garrett's estimate. It was according to Amajuba precedent, where the British loss was 226 out of about 400 engaged. Also, in Jamison's camp, that night, there lay about 30 wounded or otherwise disabled men. Also during the night home 30 or 40 young fellows got separated from the command, and straggled through into Johannesburg. Altogether a possible 150 men gone, out of his 530. His lads had fought valorously, but had not been able to get near enough to a Boer, to kick him around the Transvaal. At dawn the next morning the column of something short of 400 whites resumed its march. Jamison's grit was stubbornly good. Indeed, it was always that. He still had hopes. There was a long and tedious zigzagging march through broken ground, with constant harassment from the Boers, and at last the column walked into a sort of trap, and the Boers closed in upon it. Men and horses dropped on all sides. In the column the feeling grew that, unless it could burst through the Boer lines at this point it was done for. The Maxims were fired until they grew too hot, and, water failing for the cool jacket, 5 of them jammed, and went out of action. The 7-pounder was fired until only half an hour's ammunition was left to fire with. One last rush was made, and failed, and then the Stott's artillery came up on the left flank, and the game was up. Jamison hoisted a white flag and surrendered. There is a story, which may not be true, about an ignorant Boer farmer there who thought that this white flag was the national flag of England. He had been at Bronkhorst, and Lane's Neck, and Ngogo and Amajuba, and supposed that the English did not run up their flag excepting at the end of a fight. The following is, as I understand it, Mr. Garrett's estimate of Jamison's Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.